Hey guys, here at Sports Spectrum, we know that athletes and coaches face unique spiritual challenges every single day. Coaches often need to offer guidance to athletes who face difficulties of all kinds. And of course, likewise, athletes need to help their own teammates who ask questions about their spirituality and faith and love those who even mock them for following Christ. There are countless situations that require trustworthy resources to ensure that coaches and athletes are equipped for these type of challenges. And that's why the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and the Christian Standard Bible have partnered to make the brand new CSB E3 Discipleship Bible to assist athletes and coaches in the pursuit of righteousness as they disciple their team. This new Bible exists to engage, equip, and empower coaches, athletes, and mentors. And it has nearly 300 articles and features, as well as easily shared videos via QR codes. The CSB E3 Discipleship Bible allows us to engage with Scripture and enter meaningful relationships with our teams. It equips us to grow in Christ and share the gospel with our teams, and it empowers us to do the same for teams, making disciples of those closest to us. To learn more, visit e3discipleshipbible.com. That's e3discipleshipbible.com. Go get this new CSB E3 Discipleship Bible. It's fantastic and is available wherever books are sold.
Welcome into the Sports Spectrum Podcast, where we bring Jesus into the sports conversation. Here's your host for today, Jason Romano.
And hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. I am Jason. This is the Sports Spectrum Podcast. We are the intersection of sports and faith. So glad to have you joining us here on today's podcast. You can find us on our website, sportsspectrum.com. That's the best place to go for all of our content, articles, devotionals, podcasts, testimonials, stories, wonderful resources, all free, all that you can share with others at sportsspectrum.com. Definitely go check that out each and every day. It's updated daily, Monday through Friday, sportsspectrum.com. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can certainly email me directly, jason@sportsspectrum.com. That's my email address, jason@sportsspectrum.com. Now, today on the show, there are certain guests that I see that come over my email that somebody might suggest, and I think back and it reminds me of a different time in my life. And James Donaldson is our guest today on Sports Spectrum. And when I heard that name, James Donaldson, I immediately went to 14-year-old Jason. When I was a kid in eighth grade, ninth grade, loved the NBA, loved the Boston Celtics. That was my team with Larry Bird and Kevin McHale and those guys. And James Donaldson was a member of the Dallas Mavericks during that period. And I remember not just being a fan of the Celtics, but being a huge fan of the NBA and studying every team. And James Donaldson was an NBA All-Star in 1988. In that famous All-Star game when Michael Jordan won the MVP, Larry Bird won the three-point contest, Michael Jordan defeated Dominique Wilkins to win the slam dunk contest. It might be my favorite All-Star game and All-Star weekend in the history of the NBA. And James Donaldson was one of those guys. He was an old-school big man in the NBA, 7'2" center. He never took a three-point shot in his NBA career. He played for 15 years, came into the NBA as a fourth-round draft pick by the Seattle Supersonics, and played with Seattle, San Diego, who the LA Clippers were before they moved to Los Angeles. Then the Dallas Mavericks, as I mentioned. He was with the Knicks, the Utah Jazz, finished out his career overseas in the late 90s. And it's really interesting when you talk to a guy like James Donaldson. We got into his career, his NBA journey, and I asked him a lot of like questions that I would ask someone, you know, if I was 15, like, what was it like to be on an NBA All-Star team with guys like Larry Bird and Magic Johnson? But his faith in the Lord is strong, and it's really been stronger the last few years because James went through a very difficult period in his life very recently. As recently as 2017, 2018, mental health, anxiety, depression, divorce, multiple surgeries, suicidal tendencies. It got really bad for James just a few years ago, and he found his way out of it with the help of the Lord. And now he's an advocate for mental health, and he is actually doing really great work, I think, here in his early to mid-60s now. So James Donaldson joins us. He's an NBA All-Star, and he's got a really important story to share, and he does it right now here on Sports Spectrum. It's wonderful to have you here, James, on the podcast. My first question to you, I think, would be, you know, probably the natural one that you get from a lot of people, but I'm curious, just like I know a lot of people who may have remembered your career, is watching today's NBA. Do you watch the game? Are you a fan of the game? I've talked to some veterans and some guys who played in the league who just removed themselves from it, and I've talked to so many others who are enthralled by it and entrenched in it and just want to see how the game has grown and developed over the years. What is sort of your place right now as far as watching the NBA?
Well, the ones that are probably still enthralled by it all probably play a lot of video games. And so that's not me. So, and also, yeah, I mean, the game when I played back in the 80s and 90s, totally different game, you know, and I'm a big guy, so I don't really take to the three-point shot too often or too much. I doubt if I could play in today's game. It's just really up and down, you know, kick, you know, drive and kick to a three-point shot. And back when we played, the three-point shot was very strategic. Teams would probably shoot four or five a game, and that was coming out of a timeout, you know, at the last second shot. But the game has really changed. I'm not a big fan of it. I know all the players. I know the superstar guys. I know, and I keep up with the playoffs. I just watch the NBA Finals. So that's about all I watch, really.
Well, I looked at your stats, and I saw, you know, I was thinking, okay, you played 15 years in the NBA. You know, you're a 7'2" center. You were a post guy. You were in the paint quite a bit. But you never took one three-pointer in your entire career, at least according to the basketball reference that I saw. Is that factual? Not one time did you even heave a long shot or something just to get on that three-point attempts list?
You know, I'm the answer to a trivia question along those lines. Who played the most amount of years, most amount of games without ever, ever attempting a three-point shot? It's me. You know, I saw just the other day, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar even made one in his career. I didn't attempt any. I knew what my strengths were, what my weaknesses was. Three-point shooting was definitely one of my weaknesses. I didn't even try it.
Wow. That's just so incredible to think about, but it's a different time, right? A different era. You played on some really good teams. Who was the best shooter that you ever saw, whether it was on your team or against somebody that you played with? Because Steph Curry obviously wins the NBA Finals MVP, one of the greatest of all time, probably the greatest shooter if you ask anybody currently who's covering the game. But I know there were some great shooters who just didn't get the opportunity to shoot as many threes as Steph Curry gets, who you played with and played against. Who were some of those guys?
Well, you know, I when I was in Dallas with the Dallas Mavericks, Dell Ellis was one of my teammates. And Dell could barely get off the bench. He was behind Mark McGwire, Rolando Blackman, Derek Harper, Brad Davis. So Dell was really down deep on the depth chart. And he really emerged once he got traded to the Seattle Supersonics as one of the most deadly, lethal three-point shooters ever. He was there. Craig Hodges, I played with as well, who was a great three-point shooter. You know, Ray Allen came in at the end of my career. So those guys were around. But even then, the game was kind of starting to change from a strategic shot at the end of the game to one that you take just about any time during the game. So Dell and those guys were kind of forerunners of Steph Curry.
One of the things I was thinking about when I knew we were going to be talking was I remembered you were an All-Star in 1988. And that 88 season was a fascinating year for me personally. I'm 48 right now, almost 49 years old. But I was 14 in 1988, 15 years old. And I was entrenched in the game. I was a big Boston Celtics fan. And Larry Bird was my basketball hero in the 80s. And that was the last year he won the three-point contest. I figured I would ask you about that because that was also the All-Star slam dunk contest that Dominique and Michael Jordan had. You probably had a front row seat to watching all of that, right? On NBA All-Star Weekend that year?
I did. The game was in Chicago at Chicago Stadium. And a fantastic weekend to be around all the great players. I mean, here we are, 24 players, 12 on each team, who were picked to represent the NBA, Eastern Conference, Western Conference. I looked down, you know, at either side of me in the locker room. Pat Riley was our coach with the Western Conference. You know, we had Kareem and Akeem and James Worthy, Magic Johnson, Clyde Drexler. The list just went on and on. What a fantastic experience that was. I made it there just based off all the years of hard work I put in. I didn't have the big glaring statistics and all that, you know, 20 points and 10 rebounds a game. I was, you know, 11 points and 10 rebounds a game or something. So, but still, just to be counted amongst the best for that weekend was really one of the highlights of my career.
Yeah, I counted 16 Hall of Famers of the 24 players that played in that All-Star game. 16. And you being around those guys, it was just incredible. Michael Jordan wins the MVP, scores 40 points. And, you know, what a weekend. I think that was one of the first All-Star games where fans who were fans of the game watched it. But that was where it may have transcended a little bit past your diehard fan. Because for me, who love basketball, I remember coming out of that All-Star game and Michael Jordan took a leap. And I know he had been really good, but he took a leap. His shoes started taking a leap. The fascination, there was still Michael Jordan, or I should say Magic Johnson and Larry Bird and Isaiah Thomas and guys that you play with like Mark Aguirre. But I felt like it was after that All-Star game, tell me if I'm wrong here, where there was a little bit of a shift to where the NBA started to become popular even with the casual fan. Am I off on that?
Well, no, I think Nike did a fantastic job marketing Michael Jordan, the Jordan brand shoes. Jordan was in the league. He was still a young player at that point, but he was piling up the scoring titles and just really a fantastic all-around individual player. It wasn't until, you know, 91, 92, when he had to get by the Celtics and by the Pistons to finally become etched in, you know, the Mount Rushmore of great players as a champion. Six times in 8 years they won, three-peat and three-peat. To be around that era. And again, it was a transition from Bird and Magic, who really elevated the game back in the early 80s, to Jordan, who took it off in the 90s.
That 1988 team that you were on with Dallas was probably, if I'm looking up correctly in the stats, the closest that you got to the finals, to the NBA finals. You took the eventual NBA champion Lakers to seven games in the Western Conference Finals that year. Was that the team, when you look back, that you thought, man, that would have been the one that we could have been champions if we just could have gotten by the Lakers and maybe won one more game?
Exactly. You know, and that's where playoff experience comes in. The Lakers had been there before. They had done it several times. Kareem and Magic were the Showtime Lakers. They were a fantastic team. We matched up well with them. We played well. But the seventh game, jitters and nerves, at the Forum in Los Angeles, just was too much for us to overcome, you know, but we gave them a run for their money. Another great experience I had was with the 1992 New York Knicks, where we went seven games against the Chicago Bulls in the Eastern Conference Finals. And again, the same thing, the Bulls were just a little bit too much for us, but to be right there knocking on the door. And of course, you always think you're going to come back the next year and the next year and the next year and finally break the door down. But most of these teams that come knocking on the door, you know, things happen, trades happen, injuries happen, and you never quite get back there again, which was the same with me and the Mavericks and the Knicks.
When you're playing in games like that, are you, you know, even as far back 24 years ago, right, when you're looking in 1988 or 34 years ago, I guess, now when you think about it, are you in the moment when you're playing a game like that? You mentioned the jitters. You actually had a really good game seven when I was looking at your stats, and I remember seeing, you know, you and you did really well and you played most of the game. You only had, I think, six or seven players that even played in that game. When you think back to playing in a game seven, was that you know, the old saying is it's just another basketball game, James. I'm sure that's what your coach was saying to you, but it's not, is it?
You know, it isn't, because everything is so magnified. I mean, every turnover, every missed free throw, every little opportunity, if you can't capitalize on those things and minimize those things, you're going to lose, especially against an experienced team that's as good or a little bit better than you are. And the Lakers were as good and just a little bit better. So individually, you know, I think we played well, but the team just didn't play well enough in game seven.
When you think back to your career, you spanned a long time, 15 years, came out of college at Washington State, fourth rounder, played pro ball in Italy, you know, bounced around a little bit, Seattle, San Diego, the Clippers, then Dallas, where you made your mark as an all-star, finished your career with the Knicks in Utah. Tell me maybe your favorite moment of being an NBA player, or favorite, you know, time, I guess, or just an experience, something that might have happened to you that's the story that you tell when you think back to your NBA career.
Well, you know, I was a wide-eyed rookie coming in with the Seattle Supersonics 1980, the year after they won their NBA championship in 79. So we still had all the great, you know, NBA caliber championship players there. Downtown Freddie Brown and Jack Sigma, John Johnson, Lonnie Shelton, Gus Williams. And to be starting my NBA career out with those guys, who a couple of them, JJ especially and Fred Brown, took me under their wings and really showed me the ropes of how to be a professional and how to really get my game to that level where I could be more than just a cup of coffee in the league, but can have a long, distinguished career. I give so much credit to John Johnson, Fred Brown, and Lenny Wilkins, the coach, because they really got me started. And I don't think there was a better team, better situation for me to come into the NBA with. And from there, I was able to establish myself and move on to the San Diego, Los Angeles Clippers, where I became a full-time player at that point. I went down there with the purpose of playing behind Bill Walton as his backup. But Bill was still having a lot of injury problems. And, you know, he wasn't really focused on basketball that much at that point in his career, going to law school at Stanford University during the week and playing with us on the weekends. It was a crazy, crazy situation. But that's where I became a full-time player, playing 40 minutes a night. And the Mavericks took notice and made the trade for me. And I was able to plug that hole in the middle. The Mavericks had always been a donut team, they called it, the hole in the middle. And I was the big 7-footer they needed for defense, blocking shots, rebounding, and a little bit of scoring occasionally. We had terrific scorers in Dallas, so they didn't call on me to score 20 points a game, but get them a double-double every night, and I was doing my job.
Well, you came into the league in 1980, the center position. It was still a vital position when you retired or when you finished your career. But thinking about the evolution of that position and the players that you had to guard, I mean, you mentioned in that All-Star game was Hakeem Olajuwon and certainly Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You know, Bill Walton made me think of when he went to the Celtics, and Robert Parrish is there and you're guarding him. Then Shaquille O'Neal comes into the league, and that's at the tail end of your career. That had to be just, it would keep me up at night knowing I had to guard those guys every day, James.
Well, back in those days, you played against a 7-footer who was as good or better than you every single night. And you cannot take a night off. You know, Moses Malone, I think, was probably the one that wore me out the most night after night. Every time I played against him, I remember a playoff game with the Houston Rockets when Moses was there in the Seattle Supersonics. Moses wore me and Jack Sigma out to a tune of 38 points and 32 rebounds in one game. You know, he just went through both of us and we could not stop him. But then along comes Hakeem Olajuwon, a new improved version of Moses Malone, much more athletic and can do so many great things. So, you know, the center position was vital. And I played against Artis Gilmore and even Bob Lanier late in his career. Wes Unseld, Elvin Hayes. I mean, the list goes on and on of all those great players that I had to match up against night after night after night.
Yeah, we forgot Patrick Ewing as well. I don't want to make Knicks fans mad that we didn't.
Of course.
Were a teammate of his. So, I mean, you saw what he could do. He was amazing.
Yes, yes. Well, matter of fact, when the NBA came out with their all-time 50 greatest players back in 1996, I counted and I played against 37 of those all-time 50 great players. You know, starting with Abdul-Jabbar, Tiny Archibald, all the way, you know, through the list to Robert Parrish and Patrick Ewing. Just a bunch of great, great all-time 50 players. And I played against 37 of them.
That's incredible. What a career. Hey guys, today's episode of Sports Spectrum's podcast is brought to you by the new CSB E3 Discipleship Bible, a partnership between the Christian Standard Bible and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. I'm telling you, you're going to love this Bible. The CSB E3 Discipleship Bible is designed to assist the unique relationships between athletes, coaches, and mentors, with almost 300 articles and features, including verses for the Christian competitor, character spotlights, warm-ups, workouts, and wrap-ups, even notes on the E3 discipleship method. The CSB E3 Discipleship Bible engages, equips, and empowers readers to grow in their faith and share the gospel day in and day out. To learn more, visit e3discipleshipbible.com. Right now you can go there, e3discipleshipbible.com. The CSB E3 Discipleship Bible is available everywhere books are sold. You will not regret picking up this Bible today. James Donaldson's joining us here on Sports Spectrum. We are the intersection of sports and faith, James. I'd love to hear the importance of faith, your faith in the Lord, and how that plays a role in your life.
Well, thank you. And I really appreciate you asking that part of my life. Not too many, podcasts or interviews go into that portion, but I'm one that wears my faith on my sleeve. I grew up in a Christian home. My father especially was, you know, an usher and a deacon and a treasurer, and he did everything at the church, and he just about lived there. And he took us to church every single Sunday throughout all of my growing up years. So, you know, the Christian faith is really all I've ever known, and something I still practice to this day every single Sunday at church, and continuing to really, you know, have that strong walk and that strong faith in my life. It's gotten me through. It really kept me on that straight and narrow of knowing what's right and what's wrong and doing all the right things. You know, you talk about the NBA life, and you know, back in the 80s and 90s, you know, drugs was pretty rampant with so many of the guys. The parties, the after game socials, and the girls hanging around the lobbies and the hotels and all these kind of crazy things. And I just chose to stay away from all those things, you know, and I think it was my faith that really kept me on that straight and narrow to do the right thing, take care of myself, and to continue to be a great example of what God wants us to be. Some of the greatest experiences I've had when I was playing was that on occasion, someone from the stands, a fan, an average fan, would just come down and say, "James, you're a Christian, aren't you?" And they can just see my little light shining. And I'd say, yes, I am a Christian. And so they, you know, have a quick moment of prayer or just kind of bless me real quick and say, thanks for being me and just getting out there and doing the Lord's work. So that has gotten me, you know, it's probably the besides life itself, probably the greatest gift I've ever had.
We recently had the Hall of Famer Bobby Jones on this podcast, and we talked to him during the NBA playoffs about, you know, his journey of faith, and he was very outspoken. He was part of the group, I guess, that started NBA Chapel, where they have chapel services an hour before each game. I was just wondering, I know you played against him, but what was that like when you played, kind of discipleship and staying rooted in your faith, not just choosing right from wrong, which was obviously awesome that you did that, but there's still a growth, right, in getting in God's word, and you can't really go to church because you're playing a long season. Sometimes maybe you can, but Bobby talked about just discipleship and having chapel and things like that. What was that like for you when you played?
Well, you know, I was a little bit different in the fact that I chose not to go to the chapel worship before the games. My mind was so focused on the game, and I had to play a big physical game against these guys. you know, bashing them and beating them up and throwing them around. And, you know, to make that switch, you know, from a spiritual place to, you know, getting out there and actually, you know, physically fighting these guys was a tough thing for me. So what I did was I always had the chaplain leader of the teams that I was with to meet me, you know, two or three times a month over a cup of coffee over lunch, away from practice, away from the games. And that was really how I was able to maintain my strong faith, my strong walk. I did find churches on occasion that I could go to, especially in Los Angeles with the Clippers and in Dallas with the Mavericks, Utah with Salt Lake City. So I was always able to find a good church to go to. But I think that's really what kept me solidified in all the work that I needed to do, was to meet with the chaplain leaders. You know, Tony Evans down in Dallas was a great person. Bob Reith up here in Seattle and Utah and all these other great places. These were my guys to grab a cup of coffee with or lunch two or three times a month.
That's so funny you say that, because when Bobby Jones was on the show, I asked him, I said, how in the heck were you going to chapel service an hour before the game with members of the Boston Celtics and Los Angeles Lakers, these teams that you're trying to beat up, and then just saying, okay, thank you, Lord, amen, and then going on the court and beating them up and trying to, you know, kick their tail and beat them? He just said it was easy for him. I don't know why. It put his mind in the right place. And he understood basketball was basketball. But I was more on the side of like what you just said. I'm like, no way I would want to go to a chapel service an hour before I'm about to tip off in the NBA playoffs against the other team and then try to turn that off. I probably would have done something like you did.
You know, it was so hard to go out there and give a forearm shiver to Rick Mahorn or something. And he's given one back to me. And we were just praying for each other an hour thing. No, that just didn't work for me. So I said, okay, I need to separate this and make sure it works okay. So the guys understood. I knew the guys who went to chapel quite a bit, and they were great guys, of course. Maybe it was just the position I had to play, all out physicality and sometimes purposely trying to hurt somebody. That just doesn't quite line up too well with my Christian faith.
That was a different type of NBA then, too, that's for sure. How was the adjustment to playing in the NBA and then not playing in the NBA? I know a lot of athletes struggle with no longer being identified as a professional athlete in terms of playing, and suddenly they got to figure out what else to do with the rest of their life. You finished, I think you were 37, 38 years old, and suddenly no more basketball. What was that adjustment for you like when basketball was over?
Right. And you're right. So many of the players really struggle with that transition. I was a board of director with the retired NBA Players Association for about 8 years. And that's one of the main issues we have with our 800 plus members, is trying to help them with that transition and give them another purpose of life besides being a basketball player, which they were known for. For me, you know, after the All-Star year in 1989, I blew my knee out. I had a ruptured patella tendon, which landed me flat on my back for about 8 or 9 months in physical therapy. You know, we weren't quite sure if I'd ever make it back from that. It was a real rare injury. The patella tendon, of course, you need for jumping and running and stopping and starting, and you just can't go if you don't have a good patella. The docs did a miraculous surgery on me and repaired it. And then I spent all those hours every day for 8 or 9 months in rehab, physical rehab. And that's when I had my light bulb moment. I said, wow, if I can't play anymore, and I was only about 32 at the time, what do I want to do? And the light bulb went off of, wow, I want to go and set up these physical therapy clinics and be able to help other people who've been through a similar thing like I'm going through. And I was able to do that. So I started up the Donaldson Clinic Physical Therapy in 1989. And we ran that all the way to 2018 with multiple locations in the Seattle area. And so I had a plan. I had something already going, even though I wasn't able to fully participate in it. you know, during the summers, I'd take my prerequisites for physical therapy. I'd go study. I'd be around the clinics all day. And so I did that for several years. And by the time I finally did retire, I actually retired at 42 years of age after two or three more years over in Europe. Finally retired and was able to just kind of ease into that already existing business that I had established 10 years prior and took it over from there. So I was one of the lucky ones. I had a plan. I knew what I wanted to do. But you're right. So many of the guys, they still struggle into their 50s and 60s a lot of times. Their money runs out. They have, you know, personal issues with divorce and kids and all these other things. And that's one of the plights of so many retired athletes.
Is that where your yearning and desire to, you know, bring mental health awareness and the books that you've written? You certainly wrote this, the latest book, Celebrating the Gift of Life. I'm wondering if that played any part into the work you're doing now, especially with the mental health awareness.
Not so much. We did have a mental health therapist on board with our physical therapy. One of the only clinics in the state of Washington to have such a service. But no, I wrote this book because back in 2018, I myself went through 12 months of just pure darkness and pure hell that I never thought I would make it out of. And it was the anxiety, the depression, the suicidal ideations. I just felt life was over. I had underwent an emergency open heart life-saving surgery in 2015, followed up by another surgery in 2016, another one in 2018, and another one in 2020. So four major surgeries in 5 years. And during that time, a lot of things happened, just life events, turned my whole world upside down. My mother passed away. My wife, who I loved dearly, and her son just left the marriage unexpectedly, leaving me high and dry and trying to recover from these heart surgeries. The house I'd lived in for 40 years went into foreclosure. I ended up losing the house. All of my NBA savings, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, I poured into my business, trying to hang on to the business and save it as long as I could, and totally depleted all my savings, ended up filing for bankruptcy. Life was grim, and I had all these health issues going on as well. 2018 rolled around, and I just lost all purpose for being here. And again, this is where faith came in, because I knew that God was with me. I knew that he was having me go through this for a reason. I didn't understand why. But towards the end of all that, I had finally got a glimpse of, okay, this is what God wants me to do, is to start up this nonprofit foundation, Your Gift of Life Foundation, to write a book chronicling my experiences and helping other people, and to be a voice for mental health awareness and suicide prevention. So it's the whole new chapter, a whole next chapter of my life. All those material trappings I ended up losing. But the work I'm doing now is so much more rewarding than anything I'd ever done in the past.
Wow. Wow. I mean, I'm looking at your birth date, and you're what, 60 years old when you're having this moment, right? I mean, there's a lot of moments you said that led up to it, but 2018, you're August 57 is when you were born. So you're 60, 61 years old. Maybe I'm wrong on this, so help me out, because you've done a lot of work on this the last couple of years. Is this common with people who enter into that stage of life, you know, the, for lack of a better word, late third quarter of life? Because you hear about mental health and awareness now more among young people, it feels like, teenagers and young people, even kids my daughter's age, she's 18. You hear a lot about, you know, anxiety and depression and mental health in that group. I don't hear it a lot with people that are your age. That's why I think it's great that you're doing this and that you found purpose in the work that you're doing. Is that something you've seen as you've started to write the book and share your story and hear other people's stories, that this is a little bit more common, maybe even with people between maybe my age and their late 40s and somebody like yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, mental health challenges can happen to anybody at any point along life's journey. And that's why I wanted to write my story. It wasn't things that I did to myself, such as alcohol abuse or drug addictions. I didn't have any of that going on, but it was just life hitting me with one blow after another. And you know, we all expect for our elderly parents to pass along at some point in life. We don't expect for our children to pass before we do. And that's another big life event that happens to a lot of older people that puts them into that path of depression. Losing your job, being terminated. You know, these COVID lockdowns the last couple of years have really spiked a lot of different things going on with people. And then, of course, health injuries or health situations where you're no longer able to do what you used to do. When you get into your 60s, you start getting hit by these kind of things. And if you don't have a good, strong support system around you, you'll be prone to depression and anxiety and suicidal ideations if you're not careful. So that's my story. And that's what I want to make sure everybody understands is that, you know, if you go through this kind of thing, you've got to reach out for help. Us men are notorious for not reaching out for help. You know, we turn to all kinds of self-destructive behaviors that don't help at all. You know, drinking too much, drugs, gambling, promiscuity, all kind of crazy things that just end up ruining our lives and ruining our marriages and our relationships as well. But that's what men do. And I'm trying to get men to say it's okay to reach out for help and ask other people for help. Come on, guys, we can do better, and we have to do better.
And the faith component, the Lord playing a huge role in restoring your life, because that's, I always tell people, the God that I serve, the God that you serve, James, he's in the business of restoration. Like, that's what he wants to do. Sounds like he's done that with you.
Absolutely. You know, I never understood why I had to go through what I went through. I got tired of fighting with God, trying to figure it out. You know, I just said, well, I'm not going to get an answer. But looking back now, I'm so glad I went through it, because mental health issues is one of those things you don't really understand unless you go through it yourself. And I was right on the verge of taking my own life. And, you know, God just kept holding on to me and said, hey, I'm going to hold your hand, because if you try to hold mine, you're going to let go. And so he held on to me, and he finally gave me a little inspiration and a vision of what life would be like once I got out of this mess. And so I made it through, you know, got with God's blessing, and it's not anything I want to wish on my worst enemy. Never.
Well, we're glad you made it through. I'm glad we're having this conversation. I think it's going to help a lot of people. And there's a few websites of some of the work that you've done. I'm going to link to those in the show notes. I'll give one website out right now. Yourgiftoflife.org is the website. You've written the book, of course, Celebrating the Gift of Life. You have another book called Standing Above the Crowd. So I'm glad you're telling your story. I'm glad you're doing the work that you're doing now, James. It sounds amazing, and it's really going to help a lot of people. And if it helps one person, you know, that's worth it, right? If it just helps one person.
Absolutely. You know, it's I know I've reached thousands and thousands of people. My story is posted all over social media platforms everywhere. I've had guys call me from all over the country. They see my story. They want to reach out to me and ask me if I could encourage them to hang in there. There's six or seven guys since the holidays back in December and January that were right on the verge of suicide. And just by giving them somebody that they could lean on, somebody who could listen to them and not judge them, they felt more comfortable coming to me than they did their own family doctor or their own spouses. And I tell them that, hey, guys, you got to reach out for help. You got to get your support system around you. And really be able to battle through this. You know, the worst part of what I went through was when you start getting the voices in your head, those impulsive voices that keep telling you, just go ahead and end your life. Go ahead and do it. You've got it all planned out. You've thought about it. You know how you're going to do it. Do it. Just do it. And you have to fight back that voice to the point where it's finally in the rearview mirror. But that's part of the journey that you're going to have to go through. And so, especially with guys, like I said, with men, I really want to encourage all of us, don't fight through this alone. You don't need to go through it alone. Matter of fact, you probably can't go through it alone. And if you have faith, make sure you cling to that faith and make sure God is there for you, and he will be there for you.
That's beautifully said, James Donaldson. Thank you for sharing your story a little bit here on the show. I want to encourage people to go check out his website, yourgiftoflife.org. Again, some other websites as well that I'll link to in the show notes. And your latest book, Celebrating the Gift of Life. It is truly a gift to be alive and to be able to talk to you today, my friend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jason. And you're right. Life is the most precious gift that we have. Don't abuse it. Don't throw it away. Don't discount it. Cherish it and celebrate it every single day.
And thanks again to James Donaldson, the former NBA All-Star, longtime NBA center, for being here today on Sports Spectrum. He's got a bunch of things going on, a couple books, a couple websites. I'm going to put all of those in the show notes, but the one I want you to go check out is yourgiftoflife.org. Yourgiftoflife.org, the book Celebrating the Gift of Life. And you can just tell when you talk to a guy like James, who's now 64, 65 years old, and seeing that God has brought him out of the pit of despair between mental health and anxiety and depression and divorce, a painful divorce, as he described, multiple surgeries, really hitting rock bottom. And now he wants to be an advocate. He wants to share his story. He wants to be a voice for those that are struggling. And the stigma of mental health, which isn't just for young people here. This is a guy in his mid-60s who went through a very difficult period of life. So all the best to James Donaldson. We certainly want to see him continue to do the great work he's doing and to glorify the Lord in it. So we thank James for being here today on Sports Spectrum. We thank you as well for tuning in. If you are going through something similar to what James Donaldson is going through, man, seek help. Call someone. Let them know that you're going through it. You don't have to do this life alone. Your life is valuable. You matter. And definitely let someone know that you're going through a difficult period. I think there's a lot of people out there that want to listen, that want to help, and don't just want to try and fix you, but want to help you, want to walk alongside with you, much like Jesus wants to walk alongside all of us. So definitely seek help. And, you know, we just love you and we appreciate you for tuning in today. We hope you'll tune in next time again for another episode right here on Sports Spectrum. Have a great rest of your day. Again, we do love you guys. Stay safe, and we'll see you soon right here on Sports Spectrum.